Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Sister Janet Ruffing, professor of the practice of spirituality and ministerial leadership at Yale Divinity School since 2010, professor emerita of spirituality and spiritual direction at Fordham University, where she taught from 1986 to 2009, and author of six books, including Uncovering Stories of Faith, Spiritual Direction and Narrative, Spiritual Direction Beyond the Beginnings, and To Tell the Sacred Tell, Spiritual Direction and Narrative. Sister Ruffing is a founding member of Spiritual Directors International and a board member and past president of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. She'll speak on the topic Love Mysticism, Relic of the Past, or Contemporary Reality. Sister Ruffing's remarks were given as the 7th Annual Archbishop Eldon Curtis Lecture presented by the College of St. Mary Department of Theology. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sister Aline Paris, Professor of Theology at the College of St. Mary.
I want to welcome you to the Curtis Lecture Series, a series that is named in honor of Archbishop Eldon Curtis, who gifted us with the money that allowed us to start this series. Hence, we call it the Curtis Series in theology, and particularly in women doing theology. And so you'll notice on your program, we've been at this since 2009, and the theology department manages this series, so we try to vary the fields of theology each year. So this year, we are doing it in the area of spirituality. And without any further ado, I do introduce Dr. Janet Ruffing. So let us welcome her.
So I'm very happy to be here tonight and will be intrigued by your responses to this presentation. The Jesuit general, Pedro Arrupe, said these lines that have been passed on repeatedly about falling in love. He said, "Nothing is more practical than finding God than falling in love in a quite absolute final way. What you are in love with, what seizes your imagination, will affect everything. It will decide what will get you out of bed in the morning, what you do with your evenings, how you spend your weekends, what you read, whom you know, what breaks your heart, and what amazes you with joy and gratitude." He said, "Fall in love, stay in love, and it will decide everything." So tonight, what I'm presenting on is something that we call love mysticism. And we can ask, so as Arrupe says, it's falling in love with God, but it's also when we fall in love with anybody, we are also falling in love ultimately with God, that our loves are what bring us into God. So What do we mean by love mysticism, and why might we question whether or not this form of religious experience has a future within Christianity? Is it purely a relic of the past slowly dying out, or a dynamic contemporary reality? So first, what do we mean? Although love mysticism is an important strand in Judaism, Islam, and Hinduism, within Christian tradition, passionate human love for God that was experienced and reciprocated developed in relationship to four key aspects of Christianity. So it's important to recognize that every major religious tradition has a form of love mysticism. And we have our own. So, as I said before, this form of mysticism developed in relationship to four aspects of Christianity. The first of these is the Hebrew Scriptures themselves, especially in the Psalms and the Song of Songs, which provide a poetic vocabulary for both human and divine love. The psalmist thirsts for God, yearns for the courts of God, seeks God. The Song of Songs celebrates the beauty and richness of human erotic love in richly sensuous images. This book, considered the Holy of Holies of the entire Hebrew scripture by Rabbi Akiba, when it was finally fully accepted as scripture, became the basis of a multitude of allegorical, mystical interpretations of this text. Origen was the first to comment and was followed by Gregory of Nyssa, the Victorines, the Cistercians, Bernard of Clairvaux, Elred, William of Saint-Thierry, the Spanish mystics, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, and many others. There are countless commentaries on the Song of Songs with their purpose to bring us into this kind of intense, deep love relationship with God on a mystical level. The second strand in these mystical allegorical interpretations, the text was read exclusively in relationship to spiritual reality, either in relationship to the relationship of God with humanity, the incarnation theologically, Christ in the church, Christ in the individual soul. Those were the three ways it functioned. So first, Christ coming as incarnation, Christ in relationship to the church, and Christ in the relationship to each of us. The central metaphor is spousal or marital, bride and bridegroom. And here is the problem. Yes, God or Christ is always the bridegroom and never the bride in its patriarchal interpretation. In prophetic texts, God is the aggrieved husband of a faithless wife through Hosea's disappointing experience or the pursuing male lover in Isaiah. Despite the inherent mutuality and delight of the lovers in the Song of Songs, both of whom search and yearn for one another, the textual history of the song's interpretation of bridal mysticism as God's relationship with the church, humanity, or the individual person inscribed the patriarchal gender inequality in the metaphor into our psyches. The result was that these metaphors of love tended to stick more to women than to men. After all, aren't women meant to be fleshly or spiritual brides? Feminist biblical scholar Phyllis Tribble refreshingly restored to our consciousness the obvious mutuality of the lovers in the song and interpreted the Song of Songs as an extended metaphor for the restoration of the Garden of Eden. But this work has scarcely touched people in the pews, the way this piece of Hebrew love poetry is so incredibly mutual. And the bride in the Song of Songs has most of the lines. So she is the actor and speaker through most of the poem. Men rarely manage to identify with being the bride, despite the poetry and interpretations of male mystics from Origen to John of the Cross, Richard Raleigh, and John Ruysbroeck, in which the human soul, male or female, is always feminine. Men tend to identify with this image cluster as the friend of the bridegroom, as the best man who has to exert protective or disciplinary authority over the brides of Christ. Clergy, we've had a recent experience of this. clergy identify with the bridegroom side of the imagery when they consider the church to be the bride of Christ, which of course allows the priest to be the bridegroom. And recently, I was rather startled to learn that episcopal rings signify that Roman Catholic bishops are married to their diocese, who are their brides. The metaphor is alive and well in some surprising ways. Metaphors are slippery linguistic signifiers when they take on a life of their own, and the symbolism goes in different directions. The third strand, not only does the mystical tradition draw on the imagery of the Song of Songs to evoke an unfolding mystical dynamic between a human subject and God, but so too the Christian scriptures boldly assert that God is love in John's gospel. This gospel echoes many scenes from the Hebrew scriptures in which God is involved in the conception of children and the choice of marriage partner. For instance, Jesus works his first sign at the marriage feast of Cana. The Samaritan woman's encounter with Jesus evokes Jacob's search for a wife at another well. And Mary Magdalene, who searches for her beloved in the Garden of Resurrection, mirrors the searching female lover in the Song of Songs. This connection with the Song of Songs and the Hebrew scripture of God is our beloved is just laced through John's gospel. If God is love, as Benedict XVI so boldly asserted in his first encyclical, quoting John, the use of metaphors derived from human love are appropriate to be applied to God's love for us. And when I look at this, I want to look at all the metaphors for human love, that every form of loving has something of God in it. Every form of loving is a window onto God's love for us and may bring us into this mystical experience as part of it. The fourth strand, which is one that I am particularly fond of and which helps work through the metaphorical confusions we find ourselves in, is in the Flemish-Netherlandish mystical tradition from Belgium and from Holland. Minne, capitalized, becomes the feminine personification of the god of Hadwich of Brabant's Christian experience, for instance, and of other beguines. So in Dutch, Minne is feminine. And so when love is named as a name for God, it carries a feminine gender. So to call it love mysticism instead of bridal mysticism or instead of spousal mysticism opens up the possibilities of identifications. Suddenly, the divine lover is gendered as feminine love, and mutuality with God becomes a possibility. We are back to the seeking and finding, finding and losing, mutuality and mutual delight of the Song of Songs that became obscured in the historical rigidity of gender identifications. By changing our language in English from bridal mysticism to love mysticism, mini mystique in Dutch, immediately all forms of erotic desire and the vicissitudes of human loving and successfully reciprocated human love and friendship become experiential metaphors for carrying us into the embrace of a loving God who also yearns and longs for our human response to this deeply personal divine love. Gone is gender domination and submission, a feminist critique of the symbol. Gone are internalized judgments about homoerotic longings and desires, a stumbling block for straight men in their relationship with God, and everyone's object choice finds a place in the divine loving. Gone is the dichotomy between celibate love for God and partnered love for God. Both of those forms of love are open to this deeper mystical experience of God? Does not our committed, partnered love also partake in and mediate our experience of the divine lover as well as the experience of our human lover? So how are we to understand these powerful energies of love and desire, enjoyment and frustration, passion and peace that we experience in both our human loving and in the mystical embrace of our loving God? And if the allegorical language of the past has been rejected by men as feminizing and by women as discriminatory and limiting, what might be our path forward? What is the evidence we have in our contemporary experience that love mysticism continues to flourish even within our sex-saturated culture? Is there not some possibility that there is a longing beneath even some of this debased eroticism for the only love that might actually satisfy us? There are a host of contemporary theologians and spiritual writers who have tried to mend these splits in our lives and in our psyches between sexuality and spirituality for many years now. Sebastian Moore, John S. Dunn, Dermot Ormuhu, Margaret Farley, Wendy Farley, Susan Ross, Evelyn and James Whitehead, James Nelson, Mark Hederman, Rosemary Houghton, Charles Davis, Christine Gudoff, David Tracy, James Allison, Ronald Rollheiser, and Benedict XVI, whose encyclical Deus Caritas Est was the first papal encyclical to cite non-Christian philosophical sources on this very topic. I would say this is a preoccupation if this many people are trying to sort it out. I have been influenced by Sebastian Moore, John Donne, James Nelson, Christine Gudoff, and Margaret Farley particularly. These theologians continually dialogue with both the human experience of sexuality, sexual and other forms of love, and religious experience. How is it that we experience ourselves being solicited by God's graced invitations that move us to reciprocity and eventual transformation in a mystical process that traditionally is described as love mysticism? So it's an ongoing journey of love. And I think the quote I used at the beginning from Pedro Arupi, he is saying, fall in love with God, and this is the adventure. But there are many ways of doing this, many paths. As I've reflected on these issues for longer than you want to know, and have read widely for more than 30 years, how we relate human loves and divine human love, and how we both teach about and experience human and mystical transformation on a path of love, point to a way forward at the present time. How we answer these questions either honors the graced experience and transforming possibilities of all forms of committed loving and the experience of divine human loving that is often too deep for words and which often overwhelms and frightens our brothers and sisters when they begin to experience the power and strength of God's erotic desire for them, or we engender mistrust. So we either help people move toward this solicitation by God, or we engender a mistrust of it. Augustine got it right. Our hearts are restless until they rest in thee, O God. And yet the enjoyment of this love and the transformation this love brings into our lives requires wise and understanding guides who can hold others in this complicated embrace as it exists either as the primary and dominant love of our lives or as it is mediated in and through all our other loves. I find that an essay by theologian David Tracy helpfully informs this understanding because he offers a general theological principle in Catholic theology and shared by some Protestant ones that applies to each writer cited above and many others. I believe that all forms of love mysticism are rooted in both our human capacities for eros and love as they are met and transformed by a God whom we believe in Christian tradition is love itself, who intimately offers God's very self to us in divine transforming love and grace that draws us ever more deeply into self-transcendence and generative love and service. In short, this is what we mean by the mystical process undergone in love mysticism. We also undergo this transformation less explicitly if we don't happen to experience it explicitly in our religious experience or mystical lives. As Tracy says, most contemporary theologians, Catholic and Protestant, develop an explicit transformation model for understanding the correlation between the gift of love in Jesus Christ and our common experience of love. I have found this principle in Bernard of Clairvaux, Sermon 20 on the Song of Songs, and many other of these sermons, as well as John's Gospel. My example here is Jesus and Peter on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, that if we bring to Jesus or God our total present capacity for human love, God receives it and eventually transforms it into reaches of loving we could never reach without being met by this transforming love. In the Greek, this interchange between Peter and Jesus, Jesus asks Peter, "Do you love me with agapic love?" And Peter replies, "Yes, you know, Lord, I love you as my very best friend." And Jesus asks him again, "Do you love me with agapic love?" And Peter says, "Yes, you know, I love you with I love you as my very best friend." And the third time, Jesus says, "Do you love me as your very best friend, Peter?" In the Greek, it's so subtle, but it shows that Jesus takes the love we offer and trusts that it will develop into a deeper and more pervasive kind of love. So if we love Jesus with the passionate love of friendship, then it can be transformed into agapic love in the process. So this is what I mean by this transformative principle. Tracy generalizes this principle to say that each culture and historical era has its own model of human love and desire and their interplay with how grace is understood. So let me make this more specific. Tracy creates his own formulation of these intertwining strands of love. Agape, the gift of God's love in Jesus Christ, it is a given, not our achievement, but pure gift, sheer grace, which ennobles, empowers, elicits Christians to love God and neighbor in the self-sacrificial manner that God has first loved us in Jesus Christ. So this is what we become transformed in over time, a self-giving love that is generous and self-sacrificial. But this isn't what comes naturally to almost any of us. Eros, human striving, yearning of self for some ideal of happiness as concretely experienced in all human loves, classically expressed in Plato, reformulated in almost every age in accordance with some reigning paradigm of what constitutes authentic human love. So this changes slightly over time and also at the same time has a certain steadiness to it. Libido, which is distinguished from erotic love, is, he defines it, the pure desire aspect of eros, abstracted from the self's conscious ideal of happiness. And since Freud, it is often identified with a powerful sexual drive. So eros is a bit more refined than that, not just basic instinct, but a form of passionate loving. Philia helps add another dimension to this range of love mysticism, the Greek word for friendship love, the love of the other as related to the self and the self's own desires, attachments, and ideals. Friendship love is related to but not identical with neighbor love, so there's a greater particularity about it. And then finally, he moves into the Latin terminology of caritas or charity. Since Augustine, the reigning Catholic model, the synthesis of human eros and the divine agape given in Jesus Christ involves some transformation of human eros, which is basically affirmed as a good by divine agape, that discloses the concrete and complex experiential reality of caritas in Christian lives. So this more universal, God-like loving of other people grows over time, rooted in our ever-increasing capacities for different forms of loving. The final one is nomos, or law, love's expression through a fulfillment of the law, some expression of the role of law in both Judaism and Christianity. So there is always some version of boundaries that are part of this. Tracy is quick to add that these definitions are distinct from those made previously and famously in theological circles by Lutheran Anders Nygren, who made a much too big a split between eros and agape. The growing body of writers reject the complete separation that Nygren made in this regard. While Tracy does not place parental or familial love explicitly in any of the above categories, he recognizes that they too must be transformed by grace as they develop and change over time in relationship to maturing children and aging parents, so that even the love we experience in our families changes and grows over time, and the roles change, and it's a dynamic, ever-changing reality. And this, too, gives us access to the love of God for us. So these forms of human loving are also represented in the mystical literature as metaphors for love mysticism. So the mystics, and there's just too many to name, have these visionary experiences that I showed you represented in some of the art of a profound, of different ways of being profoundly involved with God's love for us in the person of Christ, or as Mary sometimes is a personification of God actually, or of the intimacy of the mystic being able to join the Holy Family. So you have, you know, the two nursing at mother's breast. It's an image of human intimacy, familial intimacy that we are brought into. Women mystics receive the Christ child from Mary and nurse him at their own breasts. Mystics become, this is all in their visionary experience, become infants nursing with Jesus at Mary's breasts. Such loving forms of child-parent intimacy constitute alternative images for mystical union that are distinct from the imagery of adult lovers. All of this is part of love mysticism. It is always the love being communicated reciprocally or reparatively that is the core of the mystical experience, rather than the form the imagery takes. So it's either a deepening of love or a repairing of a lack of sufficient love that's happening in these visionary experiences. Tracy identifies the giftedness of life that can be and is experienced in such positive limit experiences as a heightened consciousness of creativity, a fundamental trust in the meaningfulness of our existence despite all threats, an abiding joy and a sense of life-enhancing joy, in loyalty to an authentic cause of justice. The same experienced reality of pure giftedness is felt in the self-transcending power and force of all authentic human love, love of a tradition, a nation, a church, a cause greater than the self, love of persons, friends, family, the neighbor, and God. The intensity, according to Tracy, of these experiences of love can range from the more ordinary experiences of our everyday sense of trust, creativity, and loyalty to those intensifications of these experiences of faith, hope, love, which we call mystical states of consciousness. I think I can say kind of unabashedly, where there is any authentic love, God is there in whatever form it takes. And God is always growing us into a greater capacity for love, both to receive love and to offer love to the world. In an important essay, Eros, Friendship, and Love, The Future of Bridal Mysticism, Keith Egan, a scholar of the Carmelite tradition, argues for a retrieval of the Song of Songs tradition in contemporary spirituality. He recognizes the scholarly rejection of this tradition by those who favor a more apophatic approach to mysticism, apophatic meaning a mysticism without any kind of concrete imagery, and the neglect in recent times of both exposure of people in the pews to the Song of Songs and to the many mystical commentaries based on it. He labors in this article to repair the split between Eros and Agape in God and brings forward a neglected Thomistic emphasis on God, not only as caritas, but also as friendship. By complementing lover and beloved with a friendship model, Egan rescues caritas from mere service of one's neighbor and asserts that it needs to be in attention with the eroticism of the Song of Songs. So what he's arguing for, it's really hard to just love people in a totally unselfish way. Tried to do it, not easy. Okay, there has to be some steps in between and this movement back and forth, but you don't love everybody with a passionate love. So there needs to be this kind of neighborly kind of love, a friendship kind of love. And then he wants to argue for a passionate form of love, especially for married couples, as a pattern for how the marital relation itself in over the lifespan of a couple partakes in God's love in a very significant way, but that many people are not aware of this strand sufficiently to be able to appropriate it. In a more recent essay, Egan explores the eroticism of John of the Cross's poetry, the spiritual canticle, the dark night, and the living flame of love. Egan proposes that these poems, with all their erotic imagery, were composed from within the poet's mystical experience, the best metaphors he had for what he was experiencing in a deeply interior way. The poems are both theological and mystical. They become the means for communicating why anyone would want to undergo the dark nights and purificatory processes described in the prose expositions. In this particular essay, Egan builds on Benedict XVI's reflections on love, arguing for the healing of the splits between human forms of love and divine agape. And he argues that John of the Cross's poetry should be interpreted in relationship to his prose works that guide interpretation, and not exclusively on the poetry without their context of composition. Now, let me just explain what he means there. I teach a whole course now on John of the Cross, and the last time I taught it, I had a wonderful woman who taught Spanish literature in a couple of different universities, including ours. When John of the Cross's poetry is taught in a literature class, it is not taught in relationship to the mystical texts. So it is read purely on the human love experience. And the Spanish teacher was just, she said, I've never heard any of this before in terms of the mystical meaning of the text out of which John was writing the poetry. So, I mean, this is, it's shocking to me, really, that you would teach this, I mean, even as a literary teacher, but it is completely deracinated from its intention and the experience out of which the poetry itself was written. Since my first published essay on encountering love, mysticism, issues, and supervision a long time ago, and subsequently some of the chapters in my book, Spiritual Direction Beyond the Beginnings, I have been inundated by requests to speak about this tradition of love mysticism. The primary mystical texts are not easily accessible to most laity today. People will ask me, if I read this text, will I get the same thing out of it I get from you? And I'm thinking, oh, probably not. Because I would realize at that point how much I was mediating a text, and if someone just picked it up, they would not necessarily bring the same capacity for reading and interpreting it. Although these texts are classics, they do not always easily translate across lifestyles and cultures, and yet they are wonderful. And they continue to open up these deep mystical experiences to people who spend some time with them. Many have read Teresa of Avila and some of John of the Cross, but the commentaries are dense, the texts historically conditioned, and they often require some process of guided reading and study in order to be able to get to the deeper levels. I think some of the current popularity of the mystical love poems of Rumi and Hafiz, rendered in contemporary idioms by Coleman Barks and Daniel Landinsky, as well as Nan Merrill's version of the Psalms, provide a very accessible way to pray into this tradition through personal Lectio Divina. The Sufi texts simply name the other as the beloved. There is no gender assignment given. It is the beloved. Okay. And Nan Merrill translates all the patriarchal images for God as love. So God's name is love, and God is referred to in the Psalms as love. So using these texts, this tradition can open very easily to people who simply pick up these texts and pray with them. So it may open up in these highly edited texts. The classical mystical texts themselves, though, offer wonderful guidance and support for the ongoing process of transformation that is part of the mystical journey. The mystical journey isn't just about wonderful ecstatic experiences. It's about a total life transformation that goes along with these experiences of love. Other openings to this tradition are also all around us, in our gardens, in the way the creation is our first sensuous opening to the mystery incarnated in it. And you see Francis in his Laudato Si talking about the mediation of God to us through nature. I think for many men who find it difficult to identify with the bride in the song, their most intimate experiences of God as lover often arrives through experiences in wilderness places, experiences with beauty, music, and of human love that opens the heart. Many women as well embrace similar experiences as the language of love transpiring between them and the divine. We have lived with the great split between Eros and Agape for far too long. People want to know what these words mean. We seem to limit Eros to libido, passion, and have lost the core theological understanding of how all forms of human loving are transformed through grace towards self-transcendence, away from the self-centered focus on the self and even my little experience of God toward falling into the mystery of the divine beloved until, as both John of the Cross and James Allison assert, my desires and longings begin to shape and form under the influence of the other. So what I desire becomes more what God is desiring. The divine other who is indwelling me and shifting my center from small ego and self-centeredness to my deepest core, which is already participating in God, according to John of the Cross. Let me give you some examples as I bring this somewhat to conclusion. Of some contemporary examples of love mysticism others have shared with me, usually in response to teaching or a presentation like this. An Australian man, married and a Protestant spiritual director, wrote me after a workshop in 2007. In the course of your talks, you spoke my truth in many ways. In what I knew, I knew. In what I didn't know, I knew, and what was totally new. After sharing further reflection on his experience as a spiritual director, he ended with a poem by Raymond Carver. He said, "For me, it's what happened when we all gathered with you in Sydney." And this is the poem. "When water comes together with other water, I love creeks and the music they make, and rills in glades and meadows before they have a chance to become creeks. I may even love them best of all for their secrecy. I almost forgot to say something about the source. Can anything be more wonderful than a spring? But the big streams have my heart too. And the places streams flow into rivers, the open mouths of rivers where they join the sea. The places where water comes together with other water, those places stand out in my mind like holy places. But these coastal rivers, I love them the way some men love horses or glamorous women. I have a thing for this cold, swift water. Just looking at it makes my blood run and my skin tingle. I could sit and watch these rivers for hours, not one of them like any other. I'm 45 years old today. I was once 35. My heart empty and sere at 35. 5 more years had to pass before it began to flow again. I'll take all the time I please this afternoon before leaving my place alongside this river. It pleases me, loving rivers, loving them all the way back to their source, loving everything that increases me. Your brother in the divine silence of our oneness with God." It's beautiful, isn't it? And this image of a river moving into the sea, into the ocean, is common in the mystical texts, or a drop of water, you know, us being the drop into falling into a larger body of water as an image for this union with God. In the context of my previous comments, I trust that you heard in this poem echoes of love mysticism through the experience in nature. He never says it directly, but it's all there. And I could see you were feeling it as I was reading that poem. The poem, like John of the Cross's poetry, I guess, can be read on the purely human level, but it's not the way this man meant it when he sent me the poem. A man sitting at a place where a river meets the sea and meditates on the natural phenomenon of water flowing from source to river to sea, yet chosen to express the cumulative impact of 3 days of a workshop on love mysticism and spiritual direction, suggests to me that he was using this poem to express something of the complex experience of being submerged into all he already knew about the waters of love mysticism. And when water comes together with other water, also expresses the mystical conversation as well as the mystical experience with God. The next poem was written by a colleague of mine at Yale Divinity School shortly after I arrived. He was one of the people who hired me and just retired this year. Surely this is resurrection, or as close a glimpse of it as life can bring, to have you home again after a long absence, to walk about the garden together, to share a cup of wine on the patio where the sun sets, to wake in the middle of the night and hear you softly breathing, to feel the warmth of your body beside me, and to smell the faint scent of flowers in your hair, as though you brought the garden to bed with you. Then to fall back into a sleep that is all the deeper, for knowing that when morning comes, I will awake to find you here. Again, without belaboring a complete interpretation of this poem, I was simply stunned when I heard it the first time. Thomas's wife, Marie, was in the room when he read the poem, which only intensified the experience of it and them and what he was evoking in the poem. Another faculty member made a comment to me after the poetry reading about the extraordinary intimacy of their love captured in this poem. And this was also my first reaction. But my almost immediate second reaction was the recognition of how exquisitely Tom captured in these few lines the mystical depth of a graced marital relationship. Thomas experiences the mystery of Christ's resurrection in the return of his wife home from a trip. Their love is both entirely human and for Tom simultaneously a profound experience of God mediated through his wife. And when I gently asked about it, he said, yes, I had gotten it. So, I mean, he affirm that interpretation. Finally, two more short poems, and that will bring us to the conclusion, demonstrate facets of the contemporary experience of love mysticism. This first one was written by a Dominican sister on retreat at Gloucester, Massachusetts, one of my own students. The awakening. Out of my sleep, my lover awakened me, not with any sound, but with the soft whisper of gentle colors. Let us address the day together. And so I followed, wanting to receive all that you would share. And we waited and watched, and together all the colors of creation danced before our eyes. As one, we watched the day begin. More than creation awoke in that moment, I became alive ever so gently, drowning in your color and love. The poem is an articulation of a mystical experience that transpired at sunrise. Notice how the poem evokes the imagery and symbolism of the Song of Songs tradition without ever mentioning it. She rises and goes in search, you know. This retreatant is awakened before dawn and feels invited interiorly through colors. And what's also interesting is this woman also had a lot of eye trouble, so she didn't have terribly clear vision, to watch the sunrise with her divine beloved. She is awakened by the colors before her eyes even open, and the colors become the symbol of divine love. Yet there is also the theme of awakening. She awakens to the day. Creation itself is awakening at dawn. And she awakens to and responds to her divine lover. The final poem with which I will close was sent to me by a participant from the same Love Mysticism workshop that was not in Sydney but in Wellington, New Zealand, the same year. The poet in this instance was an Episcopalian woman who had the theme of awakening. But part of what she was working with was discerning a call to becoming a consecrated virgin, not so ordinary a form of religious life and not very ordinary at all within the Episcopalian communion. So this is a form of religious life that was revived within Roman Catholicism at Vatican II and is one of the oldest forms of consecrated life from the Pauline era of Christianity. Love mysticism was associated with this lifestyle from the earliest of times. This poem is Bright Darkness Dancing. The dark night is when the lights go out and I lose my way, only to find after groping in the dark the contours of my beloved's face, a face I cannot see but know by feeling. And so I uncover my beloved under cover of darkness, far from sight in the light of day. I discover my beloved in the dark night and the way. I surprise bright darkness dancing. More ambiguity. But still, you recognize the family resemblance of these poems. So I end my reflection with this complex metaphor of bright darkness dancing, a contemporary experience of a call to love mysticism clearly based on deep familiarity with dark night imagery, which is also nature imagery, and which captures something of the mysterious ways of love in Rosemary's Call to an often misunderstood form of consecrated life. Surely these four poetic examples could be multiplied by the experiences of many of you in this room. And for those of us who also may be spiritual directors, we recognize that the experience of love mysticism is very much a contemporary reality. I would suggest that it is just as frequently experienced today through an incarnational spirituality that draws on both the experience and language of human loves of all kinds and on solitary experiences of God, communicating with the beloved through some facet of the creation itself. More than creation awakes in us in these moments.
All right, we do have a few minutes for reflections and comments or questions if people want to.
Part of what I was trying to do tonight and try to do with this is to expand the reality and the imagery beyond bride and bridegroom so that we don't stay fixed in those patriarchal categories. That's one of the bigger things. But it is... You know, like even Francis, I love most of what Francis does, but he said, well, the church is a woman. Well, really, this church is the people of God. The church is, we have multiple images for the church, but this is the one we have attached patriarchy to. So those need to become delinked, which is why I try to expand this reality of love mysticism to say wherever love is working, God is to be found. Okay. Any experience we have of a love that is authentic and caring grows us in our love and in our capacity to be loving people in the world. And so we need to, so I try to kind of loosen up the attachment to the images as they exist in this way because they have become literalized and are no longer metaphors, but are encoded in systems that need to change. And it's also why, you know, it's like I'm intent on including married love and including parental love, familial love, because it's a much better metaphor for how we are as Christian community, as that capacity for loving in a brotherly and sisterly way expands to the larger community. So, yes, I mean, you can see. When I tried, this was supposed to be my dissertation, and I abandoned the topic and wrote on spiritual direction instead, because at that moment in Berkeley, the feminists said I couldn't do the topic because it was patriarchal, and the men thought it was silly. But they wouldn't tell me they thought it was silly, because it's like a very deep part of the tradition and an appropriate scholarly topic. But I realized I was never going to be hired by any male if I wrote that dissertation. I mean, so I was trying to write my book last semester and fell back into this incredible basic research again. So the book is not written, but I just know more about this than I ever did before. And to discover that there's a Protestant version of this in the Reformed tradition that was based on Bernard, and when the men in the Protestant tradition, they simply held on to the soul being feminine. They had no problem, and they saw their marriages as images of the same kind of love. So their godly love of their wives mirrored this love relationship with God. And they had no trouble with the cross-gender identifications. It was really, I mean, that was kind of amazing to me that was the way it worked out when the metaphor didn't get literalized. The other thing that was interesting about, because this was really Puritans we're talking about here, is there was a very high level of sexual activity among the Puritans, because 60% of the American Puritans were already pregnant before they got married. So that's we kind of take the myth here rather than the reality. But there's this like very, very deep strand of both love mysticism and nature mysticism in the New England and British Puritan tradition. So it got embodied in a completely different way than it did within the Roman Catholic Church.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Sister Janet Ruffing, professor of the practice of spirituality and ministerial leadership at Yale Divinity School since 2010, professor emerita of spirituality and spiritual direction at Fordham University, where she taught from 1986 to 2009, and author of 6 books, including Uncovering Stories of Faith, Spiritual Direction and Narrative, Spiritual Direction Beyond the Beginnings, and To Tell the Sacred Tale, Spiritual Direction and Narrative. Sister Ruffing is a founding member of Spiritual Directors International and a board member and past president of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. She spoke on the topic, Love Mysticism, Relic of the Past or Contemporary Reality. Sister Ruffing's remarks were given as the 7th Annual Archbishop Eldon Curtis Lecture presented by the College of St. Mary Department of Theology. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Brittany Long, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.